This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 41 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be talking about the concept of justice and philosophy of law in the Next Generation episode, well, Justice. Mike, did you watch where you stepped on the way to the podcast recording today?
Well, first of all, Zachary, let me say health and happiness and a pleasant day to you. I was very careful where I stepped today.
Why, thank you, Mike, for that nice greeting. Shall we just do whatever gives us pleasure in this podcast recording?
We absolutely should do whatever gives us pleasure. And it gives me pleasure to talk about Star Trek. I don't know about you.
Absolutely. You know, I'm excited to talk about this episode today because this is, on the surface, a really ridiculous episode of Star Trek. You know, I mean, the costumes and the artificial drama in this episode. This is not an episode I've watched in quite a long time, although I have just these great memories of watching this episode way back when it first aired in, I guess, 1987. And, you know, this one sticks out of my memory, but it doesn't stick out of my memory as a great episode. And yet, as I rewatched it for the podcast today, I'm struck at just how many different nuances in philosophy of law and concepts of punishment and justice get touched on in this episode. When on the surface, it's just a really visually striking episode with a fairly simple morality play. It's a straightforward prime directive morality play about, do we interfere? Do we not interfere? Do we, what do we weigh 1,000 people's lives in the Enterprise versus Wesley Crusher's life? You know, so I think on the surface, the dilemma that they face is kind of a simplistic one. And yet, like we're going to talk about in the podcast here today, there's no shortage of just nuances and philosophy of law that this episode touches on. I can't wait to dive in a little bit.
This most certainly is a really great prime directive episode. There's no doubt about it. The prime directive really is the heart and soul of this episode. But for me, Zachary, I have to say that I really feel that this episode in whole is more of a commentary on the idea of original sin and biblical law. It feels very TOS, very original series to me in the way it deconstructs God. It reminds me a lot of The Apple. It seems to me that this would have been a really good TOS episode. I don't know if it works so much for me as a TNG episode, but we're still kind of, establishing the characters. We were talking in this turbo lift that Beverly Crusher says some things that seem very out of character for her. For instance, when she tells Data and the captain to shut up and, she walks out of the room, that seemed very out of character for her. But we're still establishing these characters. I mean, after all, this is only the 7th episode of the first season of Next Generation.
Well, before we dive in to talk about the philosophy of justice, do you want to give a quick synopsis of the episode?
Sure, Zachary, I'd be delighted. Well, the crew of the Enterprise D has just established a colony in a nearby system. Everybody's tired, and they have found a planet for which to take shore leave. Everyone's excited about this shore leave opportunity. Even Dr. Crusher is pushing for it. But let's just hope, as Captain Picard says, that things aren't too good to be true here on the planet Edo. The crew of the Enterprise establishes contact with the locals, who are very playful but yet primitive, very simple, very innocent, but in many ways are very sensual people. as they are establishing relations with the locals, Wesley Crusher has teamed up with some local kids, and they are playing. He's teaching them football when he stumbles and falls into a bed of new flowers, which we discover is an offense punishable by death. So the crew of the Enterprise has to deal with the Prime Directive. Do they take Wesley out of there before he is executed, or do they submit to the laws of the Edo and their deity in the sky?
Well, Mike, as I start thinking about the philosophical themes in the episode Justice, I'm kind of going down the list of topics in philosophy of law as it relates to punishment and crime and whatnot. And the thing that stuck out to me the most is the emphasis on strict liability, the concept that no matter what your intentions were, no matter what law you broke, it doesn't matter whether you were aware of the law or not aware of the law, whether you intended to break the law or not break the law, you are liable for breaking that law and are subject to punishment. In this case, there's only one punishment on the planet, death, regardless of what law you violated. But this idea of strict liability is a concept in law that, you know, we have some crimes like this here in the United States. Generally, things like speeding tickets are a good example of strict liability, right? It doesn't matter what your intentions were if you were speeding. It doesn't matter whether you were aware of the speed limit. You know, if you violated the rule, you're liable and you get a speeding ticket, regardless of what the situation was. You know, with some exceptions, maybe if you're on your way to deliver a baby or something, right, you're not going to get a speeding ticket for that most of the time. But generally, the assumption is, you know, regardless of what your intentions were or whether you were aware of the law, if you violate the rule, you get a speeding ticket. And this is kind of like the speeding ticket of, this is taking speeding tickets to a whole new level, right? Something as simple as falling into a flower bed, when that is against the rules, that's punishable by death. And of course, Wesley Crusher didn't mean to fall in the flowers. He wasn't even aware that was a rule that he violated, but he's liable for it. And so this seems like an interesting example of strict liability, but taken to like the nth degree.
Indeed. It strikes me that when he falls in the flower bed and he gets up, the kids that he's playing ball with, you know, they're flipping out because they know that he's done something that is forbidden, and they know that he's subject to the death penalty because of it. And so as they're flipping out, I like the way he's kind of brushing himself off, and he's like, no, guys, really, I'm okay. I'm okay.
Yeah.
It's okay. So there was no concept for him that he had done anything really forbidden. He felt bad. He tripped. He fell into the flowers. I feel bad, but hey, I'm okay. Everything's okay. And, you know, let's move on. And in this case, I'm sorry isn't good enough, or I'm okay isn't good enough. You know, he's broken a law. He's done something that is forbidden. And on the surface, to you and I, it seems like a very trivial thing, but this is a serious offense to the Edo.
But Mike, what do you think about this notion of strict liability? I think, you know, Picard tries to make the case. I mean, he says as much in the episode. He says there can be no justice as long as laws are absolute, mm-hmm. right? And, you know, I'm trying to picture like someone in traffic court here in the United States saying something like, you know, there can be no justice as long as traffic laws are absolute. You know, I mean, so much of our legal system depends on certain kinds of laws, especially for these small statutory offenses. And I think that accounts for the difference between, say, traffic laws and the situation here. The consequences, the punishment for this law is death. I mean, the stakes are really, really high. But, you know, the consequences for getting a traffic ticket are fairly small. So given that the stakes are fairly low for those kinds of low-level statutory offenses, it's just cheaper and more cost-effective to have a strict liability policy and use that as a deterrent against speeding. And it's interesting because they really try to parallel, the reasoning is kind of parallel. You know, we use speeding tickets as a deterrent against speeding. And they're trying to use the death penalty here as a deterrent against falling in the flower bed. And yet the proportion seems totally wrong. The stakes, the consequences for the punishment in the episode Injustice seem really severe to our minds, given the quality of the offense. Whereas something low stakes like a speeding ticket seems about right for something as potentially innocuous as speeding, although you could you know, certainly take someone's life if you're not careful while speeding too. So something just seems out of proportion. Although it's to my mind, the problem I have with this situation is not Picard's problem. Picard's problem is this sort of absolutist nature of it. But I think, you know, our society depends to a large degree on those kinds of absolutist, relatively rigid rules in situations where the stakes are fairly low.
I agree with you, except I do have to say that the idea of absolutes, I think, is a concept that probably is on its way out. I see less and less strict adherence to this idea of absolutes. You know, you mentioned Picard saying there can be no justice so long as there are absolutes. Riker's follow-up to that was, when has justice ever been as simple as a rule book? But quite frankly, in our society today, justice really is that simple. But I see as we progress here into the 21st century and beyond that it is becoming less and less dependent upon strict adherence to rules or laws. In fact, our modern judiciary system does a really good job of really dissecting the law to the point to where we have this, you know, we have this concept of reasonable doubt, and we have become masters of proving reasonable doubt to the point that, unfortunately, there are times when our justice system fails to provide justice because there have been loopholes and things of this nature discovered in the law. And we can argue this idea of reasonable doubt. And if you're in a jury trial, as you've mentioned before, you've served on one, all you have to do is sway one juror and, you know, you've basically won your case. So I think that in the 24th century, perhaps justice comes without absolutes, and that you're not subject to a rule book. But the interesting thing to me, you mentioned that it seems out of proportion. And you're right, to you and I, that does seem extreme. You know, the death penalty for tripping over some flowers, my goodness, that's you know, you and I probably agree on the idea that the punishment needs to fit the crime. And there's just no way that this punishment seems to fit the crime at all. But to the Edo, this is very normal. This is very natural. In fact, you know, the children are devastated because they know the consequences and they know he's going to have to face them. And even the mediators, Zachary, they were very matter of fact. There was no malice. There was no one raised their voices. They just whipped out a needle and, you know, you freely admit that you've done this and, you know, we're going to exact the, you know, the punishment for it. And it strikes me that there was zero malice. I mean, there was no, you know, grab the little rat and stick this in his neck or just, I mean, they just whip out a needle and, you know, okay, we're going to have to punish you according to our laws. And it was very, it was like a very quiet business transaction.
Well, I think you're right that to us, something seems out of proportion here. You know, in our society, we do have this principle, like you said, the fact that the punishment should fit the crime. I mean, you have this practical sort of line drawing problem of trying to quantify, you know, which the degrees of offenses and the degrees of punishment. But, you know, all those little details aside, trying to decide whether a crime is worth 4 years or 5 years in prison, you know, we tend to reserve the extreme punishments for the worst crimes. And in our minds, you know, falling in a flower bed is not a very extreme crime. So the punishment seems just radically disproportionate to the crime that Wesley Crusher's committed. But as much as I love this episode, and I really do enjoy this episode, I forgot how much fun this episode is. It's a ridiculously amusing, you know, qualitatively sensual, entertaining episode of Star Trek. And it's very much like the original series. It's one of the more ridiculous things you see in The Next Generation. I really enjoyed it through and through, and I'd forgotten how much I really enjoyed it. And I philosophically, I love that it touches on these themes. You know, obviously it's raising these issues in philosophy of law and crime and punishment and whatnot. But I'm disappointed in it because I think that the episode just fails to make some key distinctions that help make sense of some of the dialogue and help make sense of some of the concepts that are at play. Like, you know, Picard gives this eloquent speech about, you know, they're not being able to be any justice in as long as laws are absolute. And yet, you know, there are some distinctions in the philosophy of law and even in morality that help that phrase make sense. You know, for small statutory offenses, you know, I think we just tend to think there's nothing intrinsically wrong. Like, you know, we used the example of a speeding ticket mm-hmm. earlier. You know, in our society, we set an arbitrary speed limit. Let's 25 miles an hour or 65 miles an hour on the highway. And that's an arbitrary number. And if you violate that, you're not a bad person. You're not evil. You're not immoral. You haven't violated some deep moral principle. You just broke a statute. And there can be disastrous consequences. You can hurt people and whatnot, but you're not, you haven't violated some intrinsic principle of morality if you drive 67 miles per hour instead of 65 miles per hour. So sure, you know, for those statutory regulations and laws, it seems like Picard is right. There can be no justice as long as speeding tickets are absolute, right? You know, there are exceptions, and there's good reasons to, you know, if you have to deliver a baby, then you can go a little faster, and there's plenty of good exceptions, and those laws should not be absolute. But then you have the laws that rely on a moral principle. Things like murdering is wrong. It's just the obvious example, right? We have a law mm-hmm. against murdering because we think that murdering is not just statutorily something we don't approve of. It's intrinsically morally wrong in some way. And so I guess my argument is that there are certain categories of crimes, the worst of the worst crimes. You know, you can come up with something, a ridiculous example, like, you know, torturing small children for fun and profit, right? You know, the ridiculously bad crimes, right? These are things that are intrinsically morally wrong. And so, I would say those are a more plausible candidate for rules and laws that there should be absolutes for, that we don't make exceptions for those kinds of rules because those are the ones that speak to our deepest moral convictions.
That's a bestseller on Franginar, by the way. Torturing small children for fun and profit.
Yeah, and it's just one of these, you know, stock philosopher examples where if you just, you know, it's like using Hitler as an example of a morally terrible person, right? You know, torturing infants for fun and profit, you know, that's obviously wrong. Being like Hitler is wrong. Murdering is wrong. I think there's this whole palette of just obviously bad things that come up in these kinds of discussions because they're the obvious cases. You know, yeah, most of the time you're right. You want to have exceptions to the rules. You want to take context into account, except for the things that are really, really, really bad. And I think Picard just forgets that, yeah, there are some things that are, you know, we don't like people who are murdering, and we have rules and laws against that, but we don't want exceptions to those. We think those are really, really intrinsically bad things and not just bad because society has willy-nilly decided that they're bad.
Sure, sure. You know, I mentioned in my initial thoughts that I felt like this was a commentary of sorts on the concept of original sin. And it occurs to me that perhaps there are some listeners who maybe don't know what I'm speaking of when I talk about original sin. This planet is very Eden-esque. It's very Eden-like. And in the story of creation, God had created a paradise of sorts. It was a garden known as Eden, and that is where he placed the first man and the first woman. And they had among their rules a rule that they weren't to eat the fruit of a particular tree. It was a tree that was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. They weren't to eat of that fruit. And in a moment of weakness, Eve took the fruit from the tree, she ate it, and she shared it with Adam. He ate it as well. And the result was that Adam and Eve were cast out of the garden. And so we have this idea of original sin. And from that moment on, human beings in that story, human beings from that moment on were corrupted somehow. We're stained by this original sin. And so if you fast forward to the time of Moses, there were 10 commandments given, unless you're watching the Mel Brooks version, and then it was 15, but he dropped one, and then it became 10 commandments. Love that scene, by the way. There are these 10 commandments, and you mentioned different degrees of laws, a speeding ticket being something very minute and arbitrary as opposed to murder that, you know, is fairly serious. So in the Ten Commandments, one of the commandments is, and I'll just paraphrase and say, you should not lie. I believe it's thou shalt not bear false witness. So you should not lie. But there's also a commandment that says you shouldn't commit murder. And so these two particular laws, although they seem very disproportionate from one another, carry this same penalty. The Bible says that for the wages of sin, the payment for sin or the breaking of law is death. So when I say that this is a commentary on original sin and biblical law, it really is, because this seems very arbitrary, but there is only one penalty, and that is a death penalty. Now, fortunately, in the sense of biblical law, God in all respects fulfilled the punishment for that sin in the person of Jesus Christ. But, you know, here it's Wesley Crusher who's going to have to accept the punishment for something very small, very minute, tripping and falling in the flowers. Again, that would be maybe equal to lying. I mean, we've all told a lie. If you've ever called in sick when you weren't really sick, you've told a lie. But according to biblical law, that's punishable by death. So I think there's a commentary there. And the way this episode also kind of deconstructs the deity in the episode, again, feels very much like the original series often did. You know, God is it's actually not an entity, it's entities who present themselves as a single God who more or less watches over these people because they're so far evolved beyond what these people are.
Well, Mike, you're making a connection that I honestly haven't spent a lot of time thinking about, but I think you're onto something with a connection between the situation that you see with these aliens on this planet living in this paradise-like society governed by very rigid rules. I mean, I think you're right. That's an obvious connection with the Garden of Eden that you described. And I think one of the characters in the episode says as much. He basically says, look, our society for generations has depended on the rigidity of these laws. These are things that were handed down to us, you know, much like the Ten Commandments coming down from the mountain, right? These are things that were handed down to us, and our idyllic society depends on this rigidity. And they don't make the case very much; they don't flesh it out. But it's clear in their minds that if they lose this this rigidity, if they lose the extremism of their laws, they don't think of it as extreme; they think of it as normal, right? But if they lose that, then their idyllic society is somehow in danger. They're going to get kicked out of the Garden of Eden, to complete the metaphor, I think, right? Their idyllic society will fall apart. And in my mind, it speaks to the issue that I think every society faces in to some degree of how to balance things like security and tranquility and peace with things like justice and compassion. You know, they've erred on one side. They've erred on the side of security and tranquility and a paradise-like society, you know, and basically have disregarded what you and I would think of as some fundamental principles of justice. Things like, you know, making sure punishments are proportionate to the crime, making a distinction between crimes that are wrong in themselves and crimes that are more statutory, that are just wrong because we say they're wrong, they're arbitrary in some way. You know, they're not taking into account these fundamental principles of justice in our society. And they're ignoring those for the sake of having a secure society. And I think, you know, especially in this day and age, when we're concerned about things like terrorism, and, you know, I think it's a scary world out there. There's a lot of reason to be afraid of things in the world, frankly. You know, you can disregard justice for the sake of security. And that is, you know, I think the stakes are kind of low in this episode. You know, we don't have, you know, it's not trying to take terrorism into account. It's not commentary on our society in that way. But I think every society has to figure out how it wants to protect itself, what kind of standard of living, what kind of, how they have a peaceful coexistence inside their society, and what trade-offs they make with laws and justice and whatnot. And I think this society just errs too far on the side of security and tranquility, and doesn't emphasize these just to our minds obvious principles of justice. And their society looks flawed to us for those very reasons.
Indeed, and to take it out of this biblical example that I've given, I think everyone would agree that, you know, we have some pretty ridiculous laws on the books, laws that perhaps made sense at the time that they were written, but they're severely outdated today. But they're still on the books, by the way. And if somebody really wanted to make a case, you could brush these laws off and start enforcing them again. For instance, in your state, the great state of California, it's unlawful to let a dog pursue a bear or a bobcat at any time.
See, I actually kind of wonder what kind of ridiculous laws are still on the books in the 24th century in Federation society. I wonder if there's something like, you know, thou shalt not transport your fish, you know, because can Picard get in trouble for transporting Livingston from one area of the ship to the other, you know, transport him down to Cetacean Ops? You know, transporters aren't supposed to, you can get in trouble if you mess with the transporters like that. So Livingston stays put in the ready room. He can't get transported.
Yeah, absolutely. Anymore. And that, by the way, is punishable by death, I'm sure. That's right. In the 24th century, that's the only death penalty law on the books. Yeah, they've gotten rid of the whole 23rd century death penalty law with the Talosians. So, you know, you've got to keep something on the book just to maintain a certain level of order. But you know, ridiculous laws, there are plenty of them. For instance, again, in California, women aren't allowed to drive in a house coat. And I'm sure that somewhere in California, someone is driving around in a house coat, but that indeed is against the law. And there are ridiculous laws on the books for all 50 states in the United States. And there are ridiculous laws on the books in virtually every country around the world. And so, you know, we have this issue of you know, strict liability. Do we strictly enforce these? What's the liability for violating these laws, and do we enforce them? But at some point in time, somebody decided, you know, that's a ridiculous law, so we just forgot about it. We haven't taken them off the books. We've just forgotten about them. And so I think that plays into a little bit of Picard's argument, certainly Riker's argument, you know, when Riker says, when has justice ever been as simple as a rule book? You know, I think that plays into that a little bit. And you know, what they're really pushing for, and what they really didn't focus on in this episode, is the fact that Wesley was an outsider who was unaware of the law. But that is kind of an unspoken truth, I think, that plays into the episode as a whole.
Well, I guess that argument only goes so far, because that argument doesn't work for speeding tickets. If you're ignorant of the speeding ticket, of the speed limit, right, you're mm-hmm. still liable if you speed. It doesn't work for murder, right? If you're ignorant of the fact that murdering is illegal and you murder, you're still liable, right? So generally, for a great many kinds of crimes, even in our own society, ignorance of the law is not an excuse. And there are exceptions. I think, you know, there are statutory exceptions where ignorance matters. And I think this is what's hard about this episode. This episode is trying to do so much at the same time. It's hard to really separate these issues from each other. You've got the prime directive theme going on. You've got cultural relativism. You've got, you know, Federation values versus the values that you see on in this mm-hmm. particular society, which obviously the Federation treats with reverence, right? You know, for all we know, this is for this society, these flowers that Wesley Crusher falls into are objects of worship, or there's some reverence around them that makes them extra special. So it seems trivial to Wesley and to Picard and Riker, but you know, for all we know, for the people on this planet, these flowers are objects of extreme worship or something. So you have all of that. You've got these legal issues, and I guess my point is just that, you know, that line of reasoning that, you know, they try to argue this way inside the episode. What they say, Wesley is ignorant of this law. He wasn't aware that it was wrong, so he shouldn't be punished for it. Well, that argument doesn't fly in our own society generally for most crimes. So what makes that argument so much more appealing inside this?
Yeah, they
episode?
Didn't. Well, that's just the thing. I mean, they mention it, but they kind of gloss it over. So I don't know. Perhaps when they were writing the episode, you know, they realized that, you know, that we're going to throw this out as a argument against putting him to death, but you know, we know that this isn't the best argument in the world, so they just kind of gloss over it and move on. But in truth, I think that, you know, there's probably a precedence to push that a little bit more, because quite literally, you know, they discovered that they have some, as Tasha put it, they have some strange laws. And in fact, that's one of the things that I find interesting about the society, is that they have a punishment zone that changes from day to day. And those zones are patrolled by mediators. And they really don't have to patrol anywhere else. You just hang out, you watch the punishment zone. It's kind of like a small town speed trap. We used to have a little town up the road from where I grew up called, of all things, Friendly West Virginia. But Friendly had one police officer, and there was a speed trap on the main highway that went through Friendly. And that's, you know, that's how they generated their revenue. It was a speed trap. And I think we're all familiar with these types of speed traps. So what you have essentially here on this planet, Edo, is this speed trap, if you will, that's being patrolled by the two mediators. And, you know, when you're caught, you're caught, it's done. And judge, jury, and executioner right there on the spot.
You know, I'm glad you make this connection, because I think this is so true. I think in the episode, Picard kind of styles humanity to have evolved past the concepts and the approaches to justice that are used by the society we see in Justice. On the other hand, you know, you basically described, you know, here in the real world, we function exactly like that. You know, if you're going to run the risk of speeding, you may or may not be in the punishment zone, right? You might be in the path of patrol officers who are patrolling, looking for people who are speeding, and you might not. You might get away with it, you know, where there's no officers around, and you might not get away with it. You know, you don't know where that punishment zone is. And it's, you know, that is essentially our approach to justice all the way around. You can't police an entire society mm-hmm. all the time. You can police part of it. You can select certain geographical areas, you can investigate certain people, but you can't police all of society all the time. So, you know, if you're committing a crime, like if you're doing a theft or a robbery or you're speeding or whatnot, you may or may not be in the punishment zone. And, you know, that, I guess, you know, we look at the society and I think we go, man, look at how wacky of a concept of justice they've got. They have punishment zones, when that's essentially how our society functions about justice for almost every crime across the board. Right?
Yeah, because whether or not you get caught really depends on if they're patrolling at that moment. You brought up the example of speeding ticket. I mean, the truth of the matter is, and I know it's this way in California, it's certainly this way here in the Dallas, Texas area. I mean, my goodness, if you're not driving 5-10 miles over the speed limit, you'll get run over. If there is an officer patrolling, I mean, regardless of, you know, what's going on with the rest of traffic, if you get caught on that radar, you're going to get a speeding ticket. And that seems so ridiculous to some people that they will flash lights at oncoming traffic to warn them that, you know, hey, there's a police officer a mile down the road here patrolling, and everybody slows down. And because we just think this is just ridiculous. Here in the state of Texas, there's actually some pretty legitimate challenges being put up against traffic light cameras. Lots of traffic light tickets are being issued based on, you know, observations from remote cameras. And so these are going to court and oftentimes are being thrown out. You know, because of the defense given against the camera. Because after all, if we start patrolling society with a camera, then, you know, we forfeit a certain level of privacy. So I think that's, you know, that's become a pretty popular deterrent from getting a ticket for, you know, turning in a red light or something like that.
Well, you mentioned the word deterrent there, and I think that's another theme of this episode that's worth mentioning. I think, again, part of my critique of the episode is just that it's trying to tackle way too many issues that are related but really kind of independent issues, and it conflates the issues. It's trying to tackle all of them at once and doesn't do any of them very well. So another issue is whether or not punishment is a good deterrent for crime in general, and in particular, is the death penalty a good deterrent against certain kinds of crimes? And on this world, is it a deterrent against falling in the flower bed? In our world, is it a deterrent against the worst crimes like murder and whatnot? And I guess the question is, how do you go about answering a question like that? On the one hand, it seems like just a plain empirical question. You can do a study and see if, you know, if we have in societies where there's a death penalty, is there a lower murder rate? It just seems like a straight up empirical, you know, statistics based kind of question. You know, within the episode, they seem to make the argument that, you know, preventing crime and having this idyllic society depends on the death penalty as a deterrent for every crime. And obviously, that, I think that seems extreme. But what do you think about just the concept of crime, of punishment as a deterrent against crime in general? I think that's one argument for justifying punishment. There are other arguments for justifying punishment, like if you've wronged someone, you can be held liable and you owe them something. So there's the sense of owing, sort of paying back a debt to, you know, someone you've wronged, or a debt to society. That's different from punishment as a deterrent against crime. So you know, what do you think about the role of deterrence in this episode, or in our own world? I think, you know, I'm not clear at all about this, because I think in my mind, there's a fine line between being a criminal and having a mental problem that forces you to, you know, in a certain criminal direction. And so, you know, if people who are committing crimes have a mental disease, a mental disorder in some way, then it seems like punishment is not going to be a terribly effective deterrent in that kind of situation. It will for some people, but not for others. So I'm not convinced of the deterrent argument in any way, shape, or form. I think, you know, there are some people that are going to commit crimes kind of, you know, regardless of what the punishments are. You know, people have, you know, mental disorders to one variety or another. People have addictions to one variety or another. And so deterrence is sort of a specious argument. And then when it comes to the death penalty, you know, whether the death penalty is effective at preventing, you know, murders or serial killers, or, you know, the worst of the worst crimes, I think in my mind, it strikes me just as an empirical statistics question. I don't have the information or the data to answer that question here from the armchair or from the captain's chair. Doing philosophy from the captain's chair, I can't answer that question. But I guess, you know, this episode seems to, you know, the aliens in this episode make the claim that, you know, punishment, this degree of punishment is a necessary deterrent. And if they don't have that, then society will kind of collapse. And it also just strikes me as something like just a really bad slippery slope argument, that if we don't have the worst of the worst crimes for every crime across the board, all of society is going to collapse. And it's going to lead to this really terrible catastrophe in their society, which is probably not very likely to happen. You know, most societies don't have that degree of punishment for every crime, and they don't fall apart. So I just don't buy this argument that the aliens give, that unless they have this punishment as a deterrent, their society is going to collapse.
Yeah, to address your question, what are my thoughts on punishment as a deterrent? I, you know, it's a very complex question, and I don't think there are any easy answers. You mentioned, you know, empirical data, and I think that's important. When we talk about empirical data, it seems that there are a lot of conflicting pieces of data out there. And in some regards, do states, for instance, to have a death penalty, do they have a lower crime rate? Well, I've seen arguments for and against. You know, here in the state of Texas, we do have the death penalty for the most extreme crimes. And as data would have it, we have a much lower murder rate in the state of Texas than some states out there that do not have a death penalty. But again, the thing with data, we've gotten so good at manipulating that data, Zachary, that it almost seems pointless to even, you know, go back and cite the data, because it can be spun, it can be manipulated. You go in and you subsegment it, and you can twist it to really enforce, you know, a peanut butter and jelly sandwich could be a good reason for murder.
But see, I guess I'm not so concerned about the data being manipulated, because it seems like, you know, there are a certain number of murders that are investigated. You know, there are a certain number of punishments that are doled mm-hmm. out. And those statistics, it seems like those are fairly hard numbers. I'm not too worried about those numbers being manipulated anyway. I think what I'm more worried about is the fact that there are, when you try to establish the causal factors from those mm-hmm. data, right? Okay, so there are a certain number of, you know, okay, here's a state like Texas that has the death penalty, has capital punishment. There are a certain number of murders that are committed, certain, you know, number of executions that are committed. And those are fairly hard data. I don't think those are really subject to manipulation. But what are the causal factors that account for why crime has gone down, or is at a certain rate? What are the factors that account for the relationship between the presence of the death penalty and that lower crime rate? I don't think it's obvious at all. You can draw a quick and easy connection to the presence of a certain type of punishment for a low crime rate. I can imagine 100 other factors that are relevant for why a crime rate is sure. the way it is. It could be education. It could be family values. It could be social structures. Mm-hmm. It could be, you know, whatever it is, right? There's a thousand relevant factors. So how can you make a quick and easy leap to a causal relationship between a certain type of punishment and a crime rate? I just think that's, even if that's true, it's not an obvious leap to make.
Yeah, because what you don't have here in justice, you have zero argument for the fact that a certain number of crimes happen because people have a predisposition, be it a mental illness or some other type of predisposed faculty.
I love the idea that Wesley Crusher is predisposed to falling in a flower bed. For some reason, that just appeals to me.
Yeah, indeed. But, you know,
it might even be true.
In the Voyager episode Repentance, we make that distinction because Iko, as you remember, when he was injected with Seven of Nine's nanoprobes, they repaired parts of his brain that allowed him to, really for the first time in his life, experience remorse and guilt. So really the argument there was that Iko, and for that matter, many of Iko's people, had some type of brain defect that predisposed them to commit violent crimes. And so do I think that that exists in our society? Absolutely, I do. I think about, again, going to Voyager, I think about Souter. You know, Souter had kind of the same problem. I mean, I don't think anyone would argue that Souter did it for pure pleasure. He did it because he had a mental predisposition that was helped when Tuvok mind melded with him. He gained a certain amount of control that he didn't have before. And so, yes, there are people out there predisposed that have mental illnesses. There are other causal factors involved there. But do I think that that's 100% of the violent crimes out there? Do I think that, you know, Wesley Crusher's clumsy, okay? I mean, let's just say that Wesley Crusher has two left feet. I mean, he's playing football, but I mean, let's face it. He's not really the athletic type, Zachary. You know, I mean, really.
Well, that's all he can play. There are some games he hasn't learned yet. So
seriously, right. I mean, he trips over his own 2 feet. He falls into a flower bed. Is that really his fault? I mean, if he were more athletic, you know, maybe he would have just leaped over that flower bed and all would have been okay.
Well, Mike, I just want to make sure we're not off on some sort of a red herring here. You know, even if you set aside, like we mentioned, the suitors of the Star Trek universe, right? The people with a mental illness, you know, the suitor is going to be a murderer almost no matter what. You know, take the people who have a mental illness in one variety or another that predisposes them to this kind of behavior. Let's set that group totally aside. The rest of society, does the presence of a punishment serve as a deterrent? I think you could give an argument that goes something like this, that if you set those kinds of those people aside, you know, and restrict yourself to people who don't have an obvious mental illness, what role does punishment play for them? Does it serve as a deterrent? Well, if they're not predisposed or they're not inclined to commit crimes anyway, if they're generally just good, honest, normal, run-of-the-mill people that aren't murderers or rapists or thieves or whatever, right? Those kinds of people don't need the punishment as a deterrent because they're not predisposed to commit doing those behaviors. So why do we need the punishment if we're bracketing the people for who have a predisposition for that, you know, towards that criminal behavior?
Yeah, I don't think we're chasing a red herring at all, because, you know, certainly when we're talking about punishment as a deterrent, we recently had a news story in our local media here, and I think it was, you know, in the national media to some degree, was a young man who injured...
Was his name Wesley?
I'm sorry?
Was his name Wesley?
His name was not Wesley.
Okay, just making sure.
But to, a long story short, and not even to get into his crime, he committed a crime. He was found guilty of the crime, but at first his sentence was kind of set aside, and he became known as the Affluenza teen. And, you know, certainly later on, his mother helped him get out of the country because he went out and got into trouble again, and they were going to bring him back in, and he was going to end up having to serve some of his sentence because he had gotten into trouble again. But, you know, his mother helped him get out of the country. And the whole point was, here's this teenager, here's his family, and they think that they're above the law. Affluenza, we call it. We've got people out there who commit crimes, Zachary, because they think they're above the law, or they think that they are smarter and able to get by. And that's certainly not the case with Wesley. I mean, he's not out there going, watch, I'm going to trample all over these flowers because I'm with Starfleet. That certainly wasn't the motivation. I mean, he tripped over his own 2 feet. He fell, you know, fell over the barrier. He falls into the flowers. It was an accident. He got up. He's totally shocked that anybody's even concerned about the flowers because, hey, I'm okay. So that wasn't the case here. And it wasn't the case that he had a mental defect. He's clumsy, but that's not a mental defect.
Well, you mentioned his intentionality. Obviously, he didn't intend to fall in the flowers, but he did fall in the flowers. And I think the role of intentionality is really important because different kinds of crimes take intentionality into account in our society in different ways. You know, certain crimes that are strict liability, it doesn't matter what your intentions were, right? The speeding ticket, I think, is just the classic example. Other kinds of crimes, we do take intentionality into account, and that's why we have distinctions or gradations of certain kinds of crimes. You know, the prototypical example is the difference between murder and manslaughter to various degrees, right? You know, if you intended to kill someone, that's worse. You know, we think of that as a worse kind of crime, has a worse punishment, has a worse moral connotation. If you accidentally kill someone, it's some variety of manslaughter. It might still be illegal. You might still be put in jail for it, right? But it doesn't, we don't sort of judge you morally as harshly for it. We don't judge you legally as harshly for it. And so it just depends what kind of crime. I think, you know, in our mind, something like falling into flowers, you know, it doesn't, if that's a strict liability crime, it should be statutory. It doesn't matter what your intentions were, but it shouldn't be one of these worst of the worst kind of punishments. But for these, you know, higher degree, high, you know, for the worst crimes, the ones that are have a moral component, you know, the things that are intrinsically wrong in themselves, then, you know, we do tend to take intentionality into account. Because if you committed a crime by accident, we just, in our society, we just make a judgment that that's not as bad as intending to commit a crime. And we make some fairly arbitrary decisions about how the degree of your punishment and whatnot when we dole out punishment. But whether intentionality is relevant to the crime seems like it's a question of which crime are we talking about? Are we talking about a fairly low-level statutory crime where it doesn't matter what your intentions are, where we approach it through strict liability? But if it's a more severe crime or a crime that has a moral component, then we place a lot of emphasis on what your intentions were. In fact, in our society, in most criminal cases, the burden of proof is not only to prove that a certain action was committed, but to prove the mental state, the intentionality of the person of the defendant. You have to prove that the person intended to commit that crime. And if not, then the crime wasn't committed. So most crimes in our society have two components. They have an action and they have a mental state component. And it's up to the prosecutor in a court case to prove both of those components. And if either one of those fails, if you can't prove that the crime was actually committed, or if you can't prove that there was a certain mental state behind it, an intentionality component to it, the letter of the law is that you're obligated to find the person not guilty. And so, you know, in this case, it just seems like, you know, I guess I keep coming back to the actual example, falling into a flower bed, right? What kind of crime should that be on this world? Should it be something like a speeding ticket? You know, does he actually deserve punishment, whether or not he intended to fall in the flower bed? And then what degree of punishment? Obviously, I think we both are clearly in agreement that it shouldn't be the death penalty. But should it be a fine? Should it be, you know, community service? Should he have to replant the flower bed? You know, is that, would that be a more reasonable, strict liability kind of punishment for Wesley Crusher in this situation? Whether or not he intended to fall in the flower bed? Or is this because of the different cultural values in this society? Is there a moral component? Are these flowers objects of reverence to the point where if you fell in the flower bed, you committed some moral violation in this society to the point where we really do have to take into account what Wesley's intentions actually were and give this kind of psychological analysis of Wesley Crusher's mental state in falling in the flower bed.
And that's, for me, Zachary, is where this episode really kind of falls flat. And I think you make the perfect argument that should have been made in the episode. I think it really comes down to Wesley's intentionality. You mentioned, you know, should he have to go back and replant the flowers? I think, again, you know, the fact that they were just able to beam away and there was really no consequence there. I don't know if I agree, and it's just my personal opinion. I don't know if I agree that that was the ideal resolution at the end of this episode. I think there certainly should have been some kind of penance, if you will, for the crime, because after all, it was a crime. Okay, the intentionality wasn't there to commit a crime, but nevertheless, a crime was committed. And I think, and again, it doesn't make for very good television, but I think at the end of the episode, if Wesley was out there, you know, replanting those flowers while, you know, Riker's making out with some Edo girl in the garden there, I think that would have been probably an ideal end of the episode.
See, I would have liked to have seen that follow-up series of episodes. So, like, for the next four episodes of The Next Generation, like, the last half of season one should all have been the Enterprise just in orbit around this planet while they stick around for Wesley Crusher's community service. You know, we get to see, you know, Riker gets to get a lot of action in that season, and, you know, it's you know, that's obviously not the kind of storytelling that The Next Generation did, but I would like to have seen that version of the rest of season one.
I would have been just satisfied if there would have been some kind of resolution at the end, I think, that made sense, just letting him beam away. For me, it didn't seem like the right ending in the episode, because again, we didn't really get to the heart of what I think this episode was about, you know, and I think they were really trying to do too much. As I said, it's a commentary on original sin and biblical law. I think they were, you know, trying to recreate something that was very TOS and deconstructing God. You know, you're getting into, you know, the nuances of, you know, the local law and the prime directive. I mean, there's this conversation that goes on between Picard and Data in the episode. Basically, Picard is saying, listen, if I do something to help the boy, you know, do I endanger this vessel and, you know, more than 1,000 other lives? And Data said, would you choose one life over 1,000, sir?
Well, on top of everything, you know, on top of everything we've already talked about, we've got this issue of one life versus 1,000 lives. So it's just at that level, it's just a straight up utilitarian question. How many lives are at stake and which direction do you go to save the maximum number of lives? So I guess I'm torn, because on the one hand, I feel like this episode does way too much. You've got, you know, the religious theme that you mentioned. You've got all of this complexity about crime and punishment and different, you know, levels of crime and degrees and intentions. You've got capital punishment as a deterrent. You've got this stuff about one life versus 1,000 lives. And it's just so, you can't almost separate these issues from each other. You know, and because of that, it just doesn't do any of them any real justice, pardon the pun. On the other hand, I think what's interesting about this episode is that sometimes real life is just complex and there's a lot of factors at play and you can't separate them from each other, like the issue about the death penalty, right? The factors that are relevant to the death penalty as a deterrent are so numerous, you can't just very quickly jot them down on the back of a napkin and make heads or tails of it, right? And real life is like that. And I think where this episode succeeds is in placing the crew of the Enterprise in this situation that they don't fully understand, with all of this legal complexity and the moral complexity and the stuff about the Prime Directive and all of these overlapping competing issues. And there's a crisis going on. They're going to execute Wesley Crusher, right? They don't get the neutrality of just sitting back and saying, "Let's think about this from the armchair, from the captain's chair, and analyze this." There's a life or a thousand lives at stake in this episode, and I think sometimes life is just like that, where you don't get the luxury of sorting out all the issues in a nice, easy, philosophical kind of way because there's a time limit on this. They're going to execute Wesley Crusher at sunrise, sundown. Or sundown, sundown, right? Not high noon, it's sundown. And so there's a time limit, and they don't get the luxury of neatly wrapping up all the issues and making these fine-grained philosophical distinctions. And I think sometimes life is just like that, where, in fact, even I think most court cases are probably like that, where there's a very rich tapestry of evidence, there's numerous factors, mm-hmm. causal factors that are at play, and you try your best to sort it out, but at the end of the day, the trial's got to end at a certain point and a verdict's got to be reached. You can't go on and on and on analyzing these factors. So I simultaneously love and hate that about this episode. I think they just don't do justice to the complexity of the issues at play. They're trying to do way too much. On the other hand, I love that they put the crew in a tricky situation with a lot of overlapping factors and a ticking time bomb of executing Wesley Crusher. And they have to figure out how to get out of the situation. And at the end of the day, if that means just getting back on the ship and beaming the heck out of there, that's one answer. But I would like to have seen Wesley Crusher do 30 days of community service. It could have been like a proto-Voyager episode. Rather than Tom Paris in the brig for 30 days, we get 30 days of Wesley Crusher's community service. That could have
been episode 8.
I would like to have seen that. I really would have.
So what you're saying essentially is that there's no justice in justice.
Essentially, that's right. those poor flowers never got replanted.
Indeed. Yeah, I just think they could have done exponentially so much more by really paring this down to a single issue. It could have been a great Prime Directive episode. It could have been kind of a tossy deconstruction of God. It could have been a commentary on original sin and biblical law. It could have been a breaking down of Immanuel Kant. Kant! And the philosophy of law, the fundamental principles of jurisprudence. So we could have dissected Plato's nomos.
Dramatically, my question is, does the fact that they didn't separate these issues and they try to do too much, does that help the episode? Does that speak to the depth of The Next Generation as a philosophically rich storytelling device? Or is that a dramatic weakness? Did they just fail either philosophically or dramatically or both because of those factors? Do you tend to lean towards one interpretation of, you know, and this happens a lot in Star Trek. Star Trek either kind of touches on issues in a real lightweight kind of fashion, or they try to take on way too much and cram it all in. I mean, not on top of everything else we mentioned, we have this sort of cultural difference about the role of sensuality in this episode, right? You know, yeah. On top of everything, we've got that moral relativism theme going on. So, it certainly given us a lot to talk about on Metatrex. So I think it does give us some degree of depth, but I'm a little disappointed at the way in which it tackles any one of those issues. So I'm divided. I tend to like dealing with issues one at a time. I think it makes for cleaner storytelling. I think it makes for cleaner philosophical analysis. But like we observed, the real world is complex and issues do overlap and there are competing intuitions and competing factors. And I just can't decide whether this episode does justice, again, pardon the pun, to that complexity, or whether this is just sort of lazy distinctions being made in this episode through and through. I would like to have seen any one of those issues be the main focus of the episode, and they just compete with each other and distract from each other. But the fact that Picard has to pull Data into his quarters and say, "Data, let's have a conversation about this," you know, speaks to the fact that, you know, these are hard issues to sort out. Even Captain Picard, who's usually really eloquent at sorting through the moral mm-hmm. chaos and the competing moral intuitions with his I would say British, but French eloquence. you know, I think Picard's really good at sorting through all of that. And here, you know, he needs someone to talk to kind of sort through the issues. And I like the fact that you can see the characters in this episode kind of reasoning through all these different positions and competing intuitions. And, you know, philosophical arguments are like that. In the real world, justice is complicated, you know, and I think that does some credit to Picard's point that, you know, justice where absolutes are concerned, you don't have justice. And, you know, the complexity of these issues, I think, helps make Picard's point that justice needs this complexity and this subtlety and these fine-grained distinctions. And if you just lay down the law in an absolute fashion, more often than not, you're going to get injustice than justice.
Sure, I agree wholeheartedly. I love that scene between Picard and Data. And from a storytelling element, Zachary, I think that this is really where they establish something between the two of them, where Picard is able to bring Data in and have these kind of conversations. And he does it quite often, in fact, throughout the whole of the series. Data becomes really one of Picard's most trusted advisors, probably next to Guinan. I'd say even to some degree more so than Riker. You know, when he's really wanting to sit down and analyze something, he brings Data in. And this, I think, was supposed to be the big curveball of the episode because, you know, Data says, "Would you choose one life over 1,000, sir?" And Picard's response is so counter to what we are used to hearing in the Star Trek universe, where, you know, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. Picard responds by saying, "I refuse to let arithmetic decide questions like that." I mean, how's that for flying in the face of what would be considered normal Trek logic?
And I guess my point is just that itself is a really interesting issue. Should those questions be decided via numbers, mm-hmm. or should they be decided via principles or via Picard's other responsibilities? You know, how do you decide those questions? And it's just such a small part of the episode.
It
you know,
barely
that
gets
one
noticed.
Little 30-second conversation, it barely gets noticed. And that could be the focus of an entire episode, I guess, is my point. You mentioned Guinan, though. I would like to have seen Guinan's advice in this situation. I can imagine Picard talking to Guinan about it, but I can kind of imagine Guinan advice to Wesley, something along the lines of, just because a girl runs into the flower bed doesn't mean she doesn't wish you to follow.
Yes, I think Guinan would have been a good fit for this episode. I agree wholeheartedly. You know, it's great though, because again, this is to me such a prime directive type of episode that we really miss the opportunity, I think, to explore the concepts of law in other cultures and other societies. I really find that fascinating.
What? I don't think it's obvious at all that from the presence of a certain type of laws on another planet, if you're visiting that planet, I don't think it's obvious at all that the prime directive is what binds you to those laws while you're there. You know, on the other hand, you know, if people are visiting our country, we tend to hold them according to, legally according to our mm-hmm. own standards. So there's some precedent for this, but I'm not sure if it's the prime directive that does all the work there, because the prime directive is like a non-interference policy or not interfering with the natural course of society. What relationship does that have to the laws in society? I just don't see the obvious connection there, even in universe with the prime directive at play.
I just think that they missed something there, because the concept of law is so ingrained in who we are as a species. I mentioned a moment ago, you know, Immanuel Kant, I believe in 1796, Zachary's when he wrote The Philosophy of Law, when he kind of dissected the fundamental principles of jurisprudence and really in many respects helped define our modern legal system, you know, but this goes back way further than that. I mean, we can, as I mentioned, if you want to go, you know, back to the Garden of Eden, you know, to the very dawn of humanity, we can go back to Hesiodos in the 7th and 8th century BC, you know, when he breaks down the concepts of law. We don't really dissect him, but he did kind of discuss some of the concepts of law. But then, you know, 300-400 years later, we get Plato, who really does kind of break law down, and he discusses the nomos, or a statute and a directive in the, I believe it was the Credo. So these things are very, this concept of law and justice it's very ingrained in who we are as a species. And I think that's what they were kind of going for in this episode, but they just really missed the boat trying to cram too much in.
Well, I think what I don't understand what the takeaway from this episode is really supposed to be in this regard, because clearly, based on the conversation we've had today, our own society today, and frankly, 30 years ago, was largely the same legal system, so it still applies back then. You know, we do take these nuances into account. We do take intentionality into account. We do take circumstances into account. We do take different kinds of offenses into account in our own legal system. And so what point is this episode supposed to make about our society today? Are we supposed to discern some sort of principles? Is there some sort of situation in mind here in the real world that this episode is supposed to be commenting on? I feel like we've already solved the problem that this episode is trying to identify. Yes, there are these aliens that they're overly legalistic. They don't take these nuances into account in their legal system. We criticize them for that in the episode, but we've already taken all that into account here in the real world. So what point is this episode making?
Well, that sometimes it's just too good to be true. You really need to study up on the local laws before you start kissing the locals. That's the takeaway, Zachary, right there. I mean, Picard said, let's just hope
there's
this
a candidate
isn't too good
for a good
true.
Principle. That's it.
And in the end, it was. And I hate to say this, but that's kind of the takeaway, if you will, of the episode, because they really didn't define, in my opinion, what this episode was really about.
Well, oftentimes when you get overly legalistic groups of people, I'm thinking of things like cults, right? You know, a group of people, you know, get together, there's some charismatic leader, and they build a fortress around themselves, and they have a bunch of rules that everyone's supposed to follow, right? You know, you know the type of group that I'm talking about. You know, in those kinds of societies, it seems like the presence of this, you know, the rigidity of these rules is not the mark of a healthy society. But again, I think we knew that back in the 80s. We know it now. I don't feel like this is a revelation in any way. And the only parallels that I see are governments that are sort of totalitarian or really rigid or do things like summary execution. So that's just kind of the political commentary side of this. But in our society, you know, we've already taken the subtlety into account. I don't think we're an overly legalistic society, just given the subtlety of our legal system. You know, I think in our society, we go out of our way to take these things into account, given the process-based, legal system that we have. I would say that's one of the things we should probably be praised for more than anything, is our willingness to entertain, you know, the complexity and the time-consuming nature of taking all of these factors into account in our legal system. It's what accounts for the bloatedness of our legal system sometimes, but, you know, we do take great pains to take all that into account. But where that's not taken into account are groups of people or governments that are just overly legalistic. There's so many rules, there's no exceptions, and, you know, punishments are severe if you violate the rules. So I'm just struggling a little bit to understand what the object of the commentary is supposed to be here. I don't think it's our society, because we do, Picard takes the position of being the evolved society in the episode. And I think for our society, we can take the position of saying, look, we're already more evolved than that. We already do take these things into account. So what is the problem in this episode?
That's a $64,000 question, I think. There are lots of problems with this episode. At the end of the day, Zachary, I think we tried to do too much here. It became an episode really about nothing in particular, and everything all at once, if that makes any kind of sense. Because again, I think we were trying to do too much in the episode. I have said that a half a dozen times, I know, already. But what I think the intention was to make this episode a commentary on how Starfleet would handle itself in the face of local laws and, what's considered extreme. I think it was a commentary about the rigidity and strict liability of the law and society. And certainly we have not so much this problem in this country because, again, we've got ridiculous laws in the book. I was picking on California earlier. Here in the state of Texas, it's illegal to take more than 3 sips of beer at a time while you're standing. I mean...
Are you pulling my leg?
No, absolutely not.
Where did you get this list?
Oh, there are websites out there of just ridiculous law. I mean, if you Google them, it's crazy, the laws that are on the books.
And they don't put anything on the internet that's not true, right?
These are
legit? Okay.
These are legit laws. Again, here in the state of Texas, it's illegal to milk another man's cow. I mean, just ridiculousness with the laws. And I think to some degree, I don't think that they were, this is a commentary about ridiculous laws, but again, you know, the idea of absolutes, you know, justice and absolutes and the idea of strict liability, I think that's at the heart and soul of what this is about. But in the process, you know, that they tried to make it a commentary on original sin and deconstruct God. And, you know, while we're at it, you know, let's play with the prime directive a little bit. Let's throw that in there and, you know, kind of get that concept involved. So at the end of the day, it really becomes an episode about everything and nothing. Now, from a fan standpoint, I enjoy this episode. I mean, this is really the first time that we see this type of pleasure planet. We don't see it again. I think it probably, to some degree, had a lot of influence on Ryza when it was introduced. I think that's what they were going for. I think they found that they had a good thing with the Edo, and they wanted to kind of create this pleasure planet.
Well, Worf likes the planet, so that says something right there.
No. Well, Worf did say nice planet, but then he went on to say that he wasn't concerned with pleasure because he's a warrior. Just saying. So even Worf isn't sure how he feels about this episode. I mean, 1 minute he says nice planet, the next minute he's not concerned with pleasure because he's a warrior. And I think that's probably my final thoughts right there. I'm not concerned with pleasure, Zachary. I'm a warrior.
Well, I think for my final thoughts, Mike, you know, I've said a lot of it already. I think, you know, this episode is simultaneously trying to do too much and also not enough. You know, it packs all of these concepts in, all the legal concepts, the religious theme. It's got the stuff about the death penalty as a deterrent. It's got cultural relativism thrown in. And it just doesn't have the chance to separate these issues as separate issues. On the other hand, that real life is like that. You throw a crew in a situation and they've got a time limit. You know, something bad is going to happen if they don't get out of the situation quickly. And they've got to quickly sort through all these issues and it's complex. So it doesn't bother me too much, but I think dramatically it just doesn't work. What I like about it, I like that it speaks to the next generation, the ambitiousness producers and writers of the Next Generation in trying to make sure that the Next Generation, had a soul to it. You know, it was not just going to be a space adventure story. It was going to be very Star Trek by considering these issues. And where they failed was trying to pack it all in the first season, right? And in general, the first season of the Next Generation is like that. You can go from episode to episode to episode, and they really pack in the philosophical themes into that first season. And this is something I know at some point we're going to get around to talking about season one of the Next Generation on our series on Essential Trek Philosophy here on MetaTreks. It'll be a ways down the road, but when we get that far, I'm looking forward to talking about that, because I think that season one of the Next Generation, people don't go back to it very much because, you know, the characters aren't fully developed yet, and the stories are dramatically a little bit weak. And despite all of that, they really packed in a slew of philosophical issues and concepts into the first season. You know, for having however many episodes, you know, 20-something episodes in the first season, you'd probably have 100 philosophical concepts they touch upon in that first season, because the writers were really making a conscious effort to pack that in. And I think that shows in this episode in particular. What I think is interesting about the end of the episode is, you know, Picard's willingness to, at the end of the day, to not necessarily stick to the letter of the prime directive, but to say, you know, I've got a situation where I have to look out for what's best for, you know, my crew in my role as captain, and what's best is for me to get back on my ship and get my people out of here, you know, and, you know, really he ends up you know, violating the prime directive in this situation. That's how I read it. So I think, as we look back at the Next Generation, I see we've kind of, how to put it? I think we've sort of retconned them as being overly relativistic and pluralistic and whatnot. And when push comes to shove, I think Captain Picard is more than willing to toss aside the prime directive for to achieve a certain goal, or to look out for his people, or to follow a value that he believes in as captain and as a human, as opposed to the values of whatever society that he is confronted with. And I think that is very much an anti-relativistic streak and an anti-pluralistic streak that you get. At the end of the day, Captain Picard will stick to his own values, however much he believes in the prime directive, when push comes to shove, when it really matters, when people's lives are on the line. And so I think we kind of look at the Next Generation with rose-colored glasses, and we sort of think of Picard's approach as being, I think we think of all of the Federation as being pluralistic and relativistic because of the prime directive. But when it matters, I just don't see that the stories unfold that way, and the characters don't make decisions that way. They follow their values, and they follow Federation values, and they do what they follow their own convictions. And I like that Picard does that at the end of the episode, even despite all of the talk and all of the consideration about the prime directive in the episode. So the legal issues aside, which are complex and interesting and nuanced, like we've talked about in the episode, I just think that this is a great example of Picard ignoring the prime directive at the end of the day when it matters.
Yeah. And he talked like there was going to be some consequences, or could be some consequences to that action, but we don't really see any consequences there. So, you know, oops, we've done it again here with this episode. You know, we've done something relatively serious and we don't see consequences for it.
And I think what I would like to see, I'm a little disappointed in the way that certain elements of dialogue in this episode are focused on. Like, you know, it's easy to make a big deal out of Picard's claim that there can be no justice where there's absolutes. Mm-hmm. And it's a passionate speech. It's very much a Picard thing to say. It's a satisfying end of the episode when they beam out of there and save the day and Wesley's not executed. But I think it doesn't do justice to the complexity of the issues. And I actually really dislike Picard's speech here, because I think Picard himself is overly simplistic and doesn't take into account things he himself probably believes about certain kinds of crimes and certain kinds of moral actions or immoral actions. I just don't see that impassioned speech, however correct it is. I think he's correct, right? You know, certain kinds of crimes don't call for absolutes. Speeding tickets maybe don't call for, falling into a flower bed doesn't call for absolutes. Most of our crimes don't call for absolutes. That's why we have different degrees of punishment and why we take context into account. But none of that does justice to the complexity. There are certain crimes that we want absolutes for, like don't murder. And there are certain crimes that we do want strict liability for, because it's more expedient or the stakes are low enough to justify it. And we make all of these distinctions in our society, none of which really come out in the episode. And I think there's a danger of glossing over the complexity for the sake of Picard's very eloquent speech in this episode.
We were talking in the turbo lift about the clothing, or the lack of clothing among the Edo. I really think that that really speaks volumes about this episode. I mean, we're trying to cram 50 kilos of girl in an Edo jumpsuit.
It might say more about us, the fact that that's what we chose to talk about before the show, as opposed to anything philosophical.
But again, I think we just tried to cram 50 kilos of girl in an Edo jumpsuit, and that really is what this episode tried to do. Well, Zachary, it's been fun talking about justice and the philosophy of law, but that isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look, everybody, at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
Please sit down. Let me get my eel.
Yeah, right. It just slapped. See, now that would have been awesome if he had just like slapped the eel in Archer's face. And then Archer, that entire meaningful scene at the end of the episode, the discussion between Archer and T'Pol, if he had a giant eel stuck to his body the entire time.
The orb.
And what's so great, I think, about Star Trek Deep Space Nine is, especially with Sisko, is you get to watch somebody slowly become a believer in a faith. And it's shown as being reasonable.
Literary Treks.
the big difference is when you're doing nonfiction books, when we the way we do them, we do a lot of interviewing, and the interviewing requires a lot of transcribing tapes, and that's possibly the most miserable job one could ever run into. It's a real task.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us tremendously, and it makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website. You can grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels, along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content through our patron zone, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we've discussed in this episode of MetaTreks, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
To leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our MetaTreks show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
On Twitter, our Twitter handle is @trekfm.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/trekfm, and also find us in the Babel Conference. The Babel Conference is Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type Babel into the search field on Facebook, that's B-A-B-E-L, or go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
I'm really enjoying the conversation that's going on in our show thread for the episode that dropped this week, Zachary. I want to invite our listeners to jump in on the conversation. Just go under our show thread and join the discussion.
Yeah, you and I observe this quite often on MetaTreks, Mike, but we really want to make the point that our opinions and our conversation on the issues that we talk about here on MetaTreks are by no means the final word on the subject. We really want our listeners to join the discussion, find us on Facebook, find us on Twitter, find us in the Babel Conference, and keep the discussion going. If you have thoughts or suggestions or think we missed an important point, chime in and join the discussion. This is just the beginning of the discussion, not the final word.
Absolutely. We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of MetaTreks on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not jogging around Edo greeting the natives, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the network?
Well, you can find me on Facebook in the Babel Conference, our listeners-only discussion group, and you can also find me on Twitter. My handle there is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not awaiting execution for falling into a flower bed, where can people find you on the Trek FM network and around the interwebs?
I am a bit of a klutz, Zachary. Well, listen, certainly on Facebook, that's where I'm most active, certainly in the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is at cmichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, cmichael1701. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the MetaTreks team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM, our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp. Also, our art director, Aaron Harvey, production manager Richard Marquez. I'd also like to say thank you to our two associate producers. They are Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at MagicDrop5. And also Kay Elizabeth Janeway. You can connect with her on Twitter at Choco Weeble. Thank you both so much for your support of Metatrex and for Trek FM as a whole. Well, thank you everyone for listening to Metatrex, a Star Trek and philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.